Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Breaking news, 0.0006% of Iowans dislike Romney less than they dislike Santorum. A tweet from comedian Andy Borowitz about the close Iowa caucus results. Twitter is so in our lives, it's funny to look now at an email that Twitter sent out in early 2011 with suggestions for how to use it, like stay in touch with friends, drive conversations. They probably never dreamed of listing track election results, drive the Arab Spring, or find a kidney. Let's spend a few minutes now on this microblogging site with John Tim Payne, media editor and writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. John, you talked to people across the board who agreed that last year was a good year for Twitter, but someone found a kidney?
In fact, a couple of people did, and it was a use of Twitter which really skyrocketed in 2011. You might call that the crowdsourcing use. That is where you send a question or a need out into the universe and say, does anybody have or does anybody know, and hope the universe answers back. And in these two cases and many others, the universe answered back. Somebody had a kidney that they could give an ailing musician, I believe, in Minneapolis. He said an indelicate word preceding the sentence, I need a kidney.
Yeah.
He just learned that he was ill and needed one. And this became a hashtag, that is to say, something that people could look up on Twitter. And somebody had a kidney, contacted him via Twitter, and I'm told he got the kidney.
This was Chris Strouth. And when you mention hashtag, that's a little number sign with a word following it. And then when you put it into Twitter, yeah, you can then find the aggregate of all the tweets that have to do with that hashtag word. And, you know, there was another woman whose mother was at the Mayo Clinic. You write about her as well. The mother was dying of kidney disease. And someone wrote about that on Twitter, too.
Yes, that's really an interesting use of Twitter, which is starting really to take over from the old one, which is stay in touch with friends, which you can still do. But now everyone's being aware that they're part of a hive mind. They're part of a network, and they can use it to actually look for resources and look for information they didn't have before.
Well, and yet how much has it changed from not just the, you know, stay in touch with friends to sort of, you know, celebrities using Twitter to send out announcements? Because you remind us of something called Tweets Per Second, TPS, and the world record was 8,868 for when Beyonce was on television and people saw she had a little baby bump. That was a big hit, and that was broken by anime fans watching an anime film in Japan who sent out more, you know, tweets per second. And that seems to say that it's still sort of stuck in a, you know, kind of a celebrity vein.
Yes, I think so. In some ways, and it's not all bad, celebrities are leading the way because celebrities found out early that they can get all of their fans to follow them. They actually organized that little hive mind of theirs, that little cloud of, I shouldn't say little, because think of Ashton Kutcher with millions of followers, and I think Lady Gaga is in the lead now. She's got more than 12 million. Kutcher actually uses his Twitter account for a fair amount of political organizing. He says, hey, they're demonstrating for immigrants' rights down in central Los Angeles today. I'm going. I'll see you there. That's powerful stuff. He's got millions of followers. So I think what celebrities have done is actually instruct people on how to use this.
Well, so John Tim Payne, what do you think? I mean, you talk to, you know, different experts across the board. What's the thinking about what Twitter does say about us?
I think that we are changing. We are changing as a species. We can make new ways of doing stuff, and that becomes second nature after a while, after a couple of generations. You know, when the phone first came out, there was a lot of discussion about whether this was going to destroy human contact. It seems silly to say that now, but it's true. You can find debates about what the phone meant when the phone first came out. Now the phone is expected. It's part of the way we do things.
Well, actually, now the phone is in some ways going out of favor.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people, the average teenager texts 3,330 times on average a month. So the phone has been superseded for instant communication for millions of people.
Yes.
So I actually think it just means that we're adopting a new technology, and if Ray Kurzweil and other people are correct, that changes our hardwiring. Think about the way Twitter was used in Arab Spring. Think about the way Occupy used it. Alas, think about the way the rioters in London used BlackBerry, because a BlackBerry gives you basically a private network that can't be broken into because it's encrypted. Think about the way that they use that as second nature almost to organize their movements. That's very new.
Talk about London for a second, because we know that there were the protests in London, but there's an anecdote about what happened afterwards.
Yes, it's one of the most heartening things about Twitter. There was such a mess after the riots in London, and people were so traumatized that three Twitter users decided to start a leaderless movement to clean the place up. And they did this on Twitter. Their names were Dan Thompson, Sophie Collard, and Sam Duckworth. And they said, let's organize cleanup efforts street by street. And so many people turned out instantaneously just about that there was not enough work for them at the end of the day. It all got done really fast.
Yeah. These were after the London riots of last August.
That's right.
And you compare this to a principle in business called just-in-time, JIT?
Yes. Just-in-time is a business principle where instead of building up all sorts of inventory, stuff on our shelves that we don't use until it's needed, we stay lean and mean and then get the stuff once the demand arises. And you can do that more easily now, like if you're something like UPS. You can get resources really fast these days. So it's called just-in-time. You assemble stuff just-in-time and get it out where it's needed. Well, one of the people I was talking to coined the term just-in-time philanthropy. His name's William Walker. He's a professor of integrated science, business, and tech at LaSalle. And he says, we've got an era of just-in-time philanthropy. When tragedy strikes, we can funnel resources where it's needed. Japan, Haiti, it's happened in several earthquake-struck regions of the world in the past year. When the Japan tragedy struck, they had what they call a startup weekend, which is another leaderless movement around the country, where people meet on a Friday, business leaders, and make new companies. And the rule is you have to be up and running with clients and business by Sunday. And one of the companies that was created at one of these startup weekends in New York was a business that got the homeless people of Japan into housing. I just think that's wonderful. And it happened in 2.5 days. They connected the people with need to people who had housing. Actually, Twitter and your cell phone have been used in brand new ways in the past couple of years. I think the first time a lot of people got wind of this was during Haiti, where you could punch in 5 numbers into your cell phone and instantly send $10 to a Haiti relief effort. And now, via Twitter, you've got a second way to instantaneously send charity and earmark it, and it gets straight there. We know that a large amount of it happened during the Japanese disaster. A large amount of it happened during Haiti. Now, Sally Fields doesn't have to get on a telethon to raise awareness for a famine in Africa. You're going to find that out via Twitter and be able to respond very, very quickly.
We're talking with John Tim Payne, the media editor and writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And John, you spoke with Kate Busman, who wrote the book about Twitter, and says that Twitter is mainstream now. It's community-based, but points out that many of the tweets are people tweeting what they're seeing on TV or on their computer. So, you know, is at least part of the tweet world a bubble, living inside a bubble?
It depends on how you look at it. I take your point most of the way, is that, you know, you could look at this and say, well, there's sort of a delusion that you're really connected when you're not. And I think that is always potential. But if we step back for a moment, you're looking at TV and tweeting to someone else about your experience. You never did that before. You sat on the couch and watched. Yeah. So actually what you're doing now is you're creating content available for other people. That makes a social moment for you, where you are saying to yourself, I'm not just watching the screen, I'm making something of it.
Well, and it can be, you know, it can be life-changing, but it can be life-saving. We remember during the uprising in Egypt, James Carl Buck was arrested. He only had time to send the word arrested from his cell phone, but the cell phone triggered his Twitter account.
Right, and a lot of people found out about it. It became, instead of sort of a disappearance, which it might have been only 5 years ago, suddenly a lot of people knew what had happened to him and who had him, and that was able to organize pressure and an effort to get him out, and it worked. Another example of the same kind of thing is what Wael Ghanim of Google did in the Egypt uprising. They arrested him for 12 days surreptitiously, and everybody knew about it, and that only added to the pressure from outside of Egypt for change. A lot of people think that at least one of the reasons that the regime changed in Egypt was pressure from the West, which grew when leaders saw, you know, that their constituents were asking them, well, what are you doing about Egypt? Because, as you remember, governments were sort of slow to pick this up.
Yeah, but you mentioned Wael Ghanem, who's been on the program, who, of course, he became the face of the revolution for many people, and that became very uncomfortable for him. His life was in danger. You know, because it is such, as you said, a leaderless kind of social media,
yes.
He became very uncomfortable with this idea that he should then become the political face.
Right.
And what about the questions about that? Recently, a Massachusetts DA subpoenaed Twitter, trying to force the site to disclose information about the Occupy Boston Twitter account. That
right.
issue is still up in the air. And we spoke with author Evgeny Morozov. He's from the authoritarian country of Belarus.
Yes.
He says, yeah, social media helps protest movements, but it will give brutal governments a way to crack down on people.
I think that that's true. See, the way that they designed Twitter was as an open platform. Basically, the whole idea was to give people a platform and let them determine how they were going to use it. So I think there's a lot of questions that have to be hashed out. If we're all networked and we all know what one another is doing, there's going to be downsides to that when powerful people want to use or abuse it. The legal questions of how far the owners of Twitter are responsible for what people say on Twitter is a very interesting one. I don't know the answer to it, and I don't think we're anywhere near figuring out. I mean, I have my eye on this Boston case, too, because I don't think that either a yes or a no answer is especially clear just looking at the Constitution.
Well, and what if we all don't have Twitter? You mentioned Kate Busman talking about it could be just like the telephone. It's so funny. I'm watching Downton Abbey. Everybody's watching Downton Abbey, and the phone has just come to, you know, England, and everybody is appalled at this idea of this infringement on their privacy, the phone. But now, you know, everybody at least did have a phone, but everybody doesn't have Twitter. Is there sort of a class divide that happens because of that?
Yeah, there is a little bit of one. A lot of people have mobile phones now. In fact, most of the mobile phones sold in the world now are smartphones. So most of the phones now being sold are connected 24/7 to the internet. That's a big change. That's not just rich. So I think the class divide, although it exists, is less and less as time goes by, and it's going to get less and less as things get cheaper. There's also a big generation divide. That's harder to redress. It's much less with Facebook because Facebook has been adopted very readily by older folks, but Twitter is really for the person who's mobile, who wants stuff right now. It's the province of the young, but I think someday it will be the province of everyone.
Well, and one of the ways it might be forced is if you have to interact with people. You found fishermen in Japan who are now selling their fish before they even get in off the water over Twitter.
Yeah, it was a brilliant moment. Okay, you know how many tuna you've caught, right? And you've got a four-hour ride back into town. Why not sell the tuna while you're waiting? It's really great.
Well, meantime, you can follow the candidates, you can follow world events, or you can, as we say, just find new pickup lines. What is it, hashtag nerd pickup lines?
It's a really great example, even though it's a silly one. It's also a good example of how Twitter can make available to large numbers of people resources they didn't have before. You can add to the pickup lines at that hashtag. You can find new pickup lines. You could try them yourself and report back on how they worked. And so you could actually start a whole second hashtag of pickup lines that work. And that's sort of how human knowledge works, is that you try something, and then immediately it's categorized into stuff that works, stuff that doesn't work quite as much. Here's what happened when I tried it. And suddenly people are sharing their actual experiences of the pickup lines.
And as you say, this could be, for genetic research. But in this case, it's just give us one of the pickup lines.
I'm looking at nerd pickup lines on Twitter right now. We can reach each other better if you disable your firewall. That's sort of a pickup line that you would give somebody via Twitter on a computer.
But you liked it.
Well, I do, because it's a commentary on being a nerd. It's sort of like this is how you would conduct a relationship by talking about your software. If I was an endoplasmic reticulum, how would you want me, smooth or rough? Because there are two endoplasmic reticula in human cell, but you have to know that in order for it to be funny, which it is actually pretty funny if you're a biology expert. If you were oxygen, I would be an alkali metal so I could get in you and explode.
OK. Okay,
oh,
all
that's
right.
That's really good. See, and you have to know chemistry to do that one. So, okay, so they're nerd pickup lines that are for people who study science or study software. But you could do that with regular pickup lines. You could do that with, let's say there's an earthquake in your region. You could say nearest food bank, right? And everyone who has Twitter but might not have a phone could then make their way there, you know, yeah. Or here's where you go to find out where your family members are. This is happening a lot more in Twitter. 2011 was the year I think it became sort of an accepted way of, it's crowdsourcing is what it is.
Without having to be in the crowd, the actual crowd.
Right.
John Tim Payne, media editor and writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, taking a look at Twitter for us. John, just terrific. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.